Hello, and welcome to Thinking Aloud. My name is Mike Earle. This is show number 6. On these past few programs, we've been exploring ideas related to the subject of knowledge. I'll be returning to those ideas in a future show, but today, I want to turn our attention to a subject that I suspect is near and dear to all of us, and that is the subject of human consciousness. Over the past few years, I've had a growing interest in the philosophy of mind. I've been especially fascinated by something the philosopher David Chalmers has called the hard problem of consciousness. The hard problem asks the question, how do we go from a brain, essentially a 3-pound piece of flesh, to the experience of eating a good meal, or listening to a favorite song, or gazing into the eyes of someone you love? In short, how do we go from the physics of the brain to that first-person subjective experience that we call human consciousness? That's the hard problem. Harvard psychologist Steven Pinker has observed that, from a purely scientific point of view, the hard problem is hard because no one knows what a solution might look like, or even whether there is a genuine scientific solution. Some philosophers believe that the hard problem is so hard that human beings will never solve it. They argue that our intellectual capacities evolved to survive on African savannas, not to understand the nature of our own being. Well, I for one believe that we can solve the hard problem. But to solve this problem, I believe we must first overcome a very powerful natural illusion. This should not come as a total surprise. Looking back over the history of ideas, one could argue that many of the great episodes of intellectual advance began with the overcoming of some compelling natural illusion. The illusion that the world is flat. The illusion that the world stands still. The illusion that objects in the heavens and objects on earth are governed by different laws. The illusion that species are intelligently designed. People once lived under all of these illusions, and for thousands of years, and it's perfectly understandable why they did. To the casual observer, that's just how things appear. But they are illusions. They are mistaken conceptions of the world, and as such, they are obstacles to intellectual progress. The fact that people once lived under all of these illusions and had no idea they were living under these illusions raises an important and perhaps unsettling question. Could we today, at the dawn of the 21st century, be living under some powerful illusion and not yet realize it? I believe the answer to that question is yes. On today's program, I'll be sharing with you what I think that illusion is, and why I think we must overcome it if we ever hope to solve the hard problem of consciousness. Now, before I begin, let me issue a quick caveat. Near the end of today's program, I'll be proposing an idea that will probably strike many of you as utterly preposterous. Let me acknowledge right up front that I am fully aware that I might be wrong about all of this. I'm only human. But even if I am wrong, I think there's an idea here that is interesting and worth your consideration. And who knows? It might actually turn out to be right. And so, with that caveat out of the way, let's get started. Not long ago, I was out taking an afternoon walk when I came across a large pond. It was a clear, calm day, and the pond was perfectly still, resulting in an unusually vivid reflection on its surface. This reflection was so vivid that if I stood really still, I could almost convince myself that I was looking at a gigantic photograph that someone had draped over the pond's surface. That's how clear this thing was. It was while I was standing there staring at this picture on the pond surface that I had a strange thought. Someone standing on the other side of the pond would see a completely different picture from the one I saw, even though he would be looking at the very same surface of the very same pond at the very same time. Now think about this. Two people looking at the very same thing at the very same time and seeing two completely different images. This is really kind of weird when you stop and think about it. Of course, as any physicist will tell us, there is no image on the pond itself. That's an illusion. What I'm really looking at is light that has radiated off of the object situated on the other side of the pond. It's just that the light that constitutes this image I'm seeing has taken an indirect route from the objects to my eyeballs by first reflecting off the pond surface. So it's a reflection. And of course it's a reflection. We all know it's a reflection. It's a trivial fact. But let's consider this trivial fact in just a bit more detail. I'm standing on one side of the pond, and there is some object on the other side of the pond. Let's say a tree. Now, the physicist tells me that light, in the form of photons, is radiating off of this tree in all directions. We can almost think of the photons radiating off of this tree as if they were water droplets spraying out of a sprinkler. Now, because these photons are radiating in all directions, a portion of them will be traveling in the direction of the pond. These photons will reflect off the pond surface, and a portion of these reflected photons will continue on to my eyeballs. And so, what appears to me to be a picture of a tree on the pond surface is in fact light that originated from the actual tree itself. That's why this picture on the pond surface changes as I move around the pond. As I move around, there will be different objects on the opposite side of the pond. And it's the light radiating off of those objects that constitute the image that I see. And that's really the point I want to stress here. When we look at an object or the reflection of an object, we aren't really looking at the object itself. Rather, we're looking at light that is radiated off of that object. Unfortunately, there's a problem with this explanation. And I remember coming to grips with this problem as I stood there staring at this pond. Think about this. If my visual experience involved looking at photons, then I really shouldn't see anything at all. Now, why do I say that? Well, it's due to something that I like to call the driving in a snowstorm at night with your bright lights on effect. I don't know if you've ever had the experience of driving at night in a snowstorm, but if you have, you probably know that it's not a very good idea to drive with your bright lights on. And that's because when you shine your bright lights in a snowstorm, you illuminate the zillions of snowflakes in front of your car, which only serves to block your view of objects further down the road. So it effectively blinds you. We run into a similar problem if we think of visual experience resulting from looking at light. Remember, photons are radiating from a visible object like water spraying from a sprinkler. This means that in between you and some object you're looking at is a veritable deluge of photons barreling in your direction. Right? Now, if visual experience involves you looking out into this onslaught of photons, you should encounter this driving in a snowstorm at night with your bright lights on effect, with the result being that you wouldn't see anything at all. And yet, the visual scene before you is crystal clear. This seems impossible. So how do we account for the fact that we see anything at all? The only way to make sense of this seeming paradox is to totally rethink our common sense notion of visual experience. And here we encounter a useful entry point toward recognizing this powerful illusion that I spoke of in the introduction. According to people who study the brain, our visual experience of an object does not arise from looking at the object itself, or even from looking at the light radiating off of that object, even though it very much feels that way. I think it's interesting how our language reflects, no pun intended, our common sense notion of visual experience. We say that we look at something, or that we look out onto the world. We seem to think of our two eyeballs as if they were two headlights beaming out onto the world. And it does seem to feel that way. But according to brain experts, visual experience is not an out thing. It's an in thing. Your visual experience of the world takes place entirely inside your brain. Visual experience begins at the retina, which is technically part of the brain. You have two retinas, one situated at the back of each eyeball. Each retina contains a two-dimensional sheet of roughly 100 million light-sensitive cells called photoreceptors. It's the two-dimensional aspect of these photoreceptive sheets that accounts for why we don't experience this driving in a snowstorm at night with the bright lights on effect. Now, our common sense notion of visual experience is one of looking out into a three-dimensional world. Now, if you really were looking out into a three-dimensional world, you would see nothing but a blur of photon snow. But that's not what you experience. What you experience is a clear, sharp image. And the reason you experience a clear, sharp image is because your sensory interface with the outside world is not a three-dimensional apparatus. It's a two-dimensional apparatus. The foundation of your visual experience is this flat sheet of photoreceptive cells in your retina. So, in a manner of speaking, what you are looking at is not the outside world. What you are looking at is your retina. Now, to be sure, visual experience involves additional processing in other parts of the brain. But your retina is ground zero, and your retina is part of your brain. You do not experience the world. You experience your brain. This will probably strike many people as a weird idea. And it's an idea that only gets weirder when we learn that this principle extends beyond visual experience. Everything we experience, everything we are, all of it, is manufactured and experienced within the confines of our brains. The late Francis Crick called this idea the astonishing hypothesis. But as astonishing as this idea may be, it's an idea that gives rise to an even more astonishing implication. An implication not about our experience of the world, but about the nature of the world itself. In confronting this implication, we come face to face with that illusion I mentioned in the introduction. An illusion so utterly compelling that is something that I like to call the ultimate illusion. Before we confront this ultimate illusion, I want to return briefly to a subject I mentioned earlier, the hard problem of consciousness. Let's say that I hand you a photograph of Halle Berry, and I ask you to simply look at this photograph, which should be easy since it's a photograph of Halle Berry. Now, brain experts tell us that all visual experience takes place in the brain. If they're right about this, then your experience of this photograph is taking place in your brain. And yet, if we could unscrew the top of your head and examine your brain at the exact moment you're having this experience, we would find nothing in your brain that looks even remotely like Halle Berry. This is a very curious thing. I mean, if all of our experience takes place in the brain, then it follows that the brain must be some kind of factory in which experiences are manufactured. I mean, barring some kind of miracle, how else could it be? But this presents us with a problem. In the case of this Halle Berry photograph, when we look inside your brain, we find nothing on the factory floor that looks anything like Halle Berry. Not even bits and pieces of her. This is not what we would expect. Think for a moment of a factory that manufactures cars. If we visit a car factory, we find things that look like cars and parts of cars. Car bodies, car engines, steel frames, plastic cup holders, paint, leather, glass. We recognize all of these things as being parts of cars, and we expect to find these things in a factory that manufactures cars. And we expect this of any factory, whether they're making computers or golf clubs or potato chips or dog food or whatever. When we tour the factories that make these products, we expect to find, and we in fact do find, stuff that looks like these products, and sounds like these products, and smells like these products, and tastes like these products. Not so with your brain. When we unscrew the top of your head and take a tour of this factory that is allegedly manufacturing your experience of Halle Berry, we find nothing that looks in any way, shape, or form like Halle Berry. And yet, there she is. In your experience. But the experience is in your brain, entirely. And yet there's nothing in your brain that resembles the experience. But the experience is in your brain, the experts tell us. But there's nothing in your brain that resembles the experience. But the experience is in your brain. Can you see our dilemma? Bridging the gap between the activity of a physical brain and the experience of looking at Halle Berry or listening to a Beethoven symphony or biting into a taco or whatever. This explanatory gap between physics and feelings is something the philosopher David Chalmers has called the hard problem of consciousness. Incidentally, there's an easy problem of consciousness as well. The easy problem is the challenge of formulating a physical description of the brain activities that correspond to various aspects of conscious experience. A solution to the easy problem would likely include a map of various brain regions, an inventory of the key neurotransmitters, and a schematic showing how these parts interact to produce the brain states that correspond to our various conscious experiences. That's the easy problem. Incidentally, the easy problem is by no stretch of the imagination an easy problem. Steven Pinker recently joked that the easy problem is easy in the same way that sending someone to Mars is easy. It's easy only in the sense that we at least have some idea of how we'd go about solving it. And given enough time and resources, we probably could solve it. The hard problem is an altogether different animal. The hard problem is about explaining how this mysterious, subjective, first-person experience can arise from all of this brain activity, all of these buzzing neurons. Philosophers consider the problem hard because, unlike the easy problem, it is unclear how we would even begin to solve such a problem or what a solution might conceivably look like. And as I mentioned in the introduction, some experts believe the hard problem will never be solved. I happen to believe that we can solve the hard problem, but the solution is going to require that we first recognize and overcome a very powerful illusion. Our challenge will not be unlike the one Copernicus faced as he tried to explain the motions of the planets. Before he could even begin to unravel that mystery, Copernicus had to overcome the compelling illusion that the Earth does not move and that the heavenly bodies, including the sun, go around us. Before we can even begin to unravel the mystery of consciousness, I believe we must overcome an illusion every bit as compelling as the one Copernicus faced. And until we see through this illusion, the human mind will remain an impossible mystery. If we fail to see through this illusion, we will be like a man trying to find his way through Chicago using a map of Detroit. The first step to our solution is to recognize that we are working with the wrong map. And this means recognizing that we are living under an illusion. For me, overcoming this illusion began with the realization that my experience of the world takes place entirely within my brain. Brain experts tell us that this is the case, but you don't have to take their word for it. There are things that you can do, all by yourself, to convince yourself that this is indeed the case. You can go outside and look at the reflection on the surface of a pond, or in a mirror for that matter, and simply contemplate what must be the case for an experience like that to be possible at all. If you do that, eventually it will hit you. You experience your brain, not the world. That's what I mean by realization. But this realization is just an entry point. It's the first step down a path that leads to a recognition of what I'm calling the ultimate illusion. Let me now show you where I think this path ultimately leads us. This path takes us first to a consideration of something philosophers call emergent properties. According to Wikipedia, an emergent property of a system is one that is not a property of any component of that system, but is still a feature of the system as a whole. Emergent properties are fascinating things that most people never think about. And yet when we do think about them, they can seem almost like magic. Let me illustrate with an example. You're probably familiar with the toy building bricks called Legos. Let's imagine that I have a pile of these Lego bricks. Each brick is the same size and same shape. Let's say those little rectangular ones, but in two colors, red and white. So, I have this pile of red and white Lego bricks, and from this pile, I'm going to make stuff. And you're going to watch me make stuff. And the first thing I'm going to make is a little dog. And with no prompting from me, you look at my little creation here and you say, "That's a dog." And I say, right. I then disassemble this dog back into a pile of individual Lego bricks and then proceed to reassemble them back into a new shape. This time I make a truck. And again, without any prompting from me, you look at this thing and you say, that's a truck. And I say, right. I then disassemble the truck back into a pile of individual Lego bricks and then reassemble them into something new. This time, a little airplane. And you say, that's an airplane. And I say, right again. And I go on and on like this. I make a Lego house and a Lego palm tree and a Lego man and a Lego pig. And all of these things are being constructed from the very same pile of red and white Lego bricks. And now a question. What exactly are these things emerging out of this pile of Lego bricks? What is this dog and truck and airplane? It almost seems as though we're conjuring spirits at a seance. What are these entities and where do they come from? These entities are emergent properties. They are properties or features that we don't find in any component of the system, but that we do find in the system as a whole. In the case of my Lego dog, for example, we don't find a dog in any individual Lego brick, but we do see a dog in the system as a whole. Thus, the dog is an emergent property. What we have here, then, are two very different things. We have the parts, and we have the emergent property. In the example of my Lego dog, the individual Lego bricks are the parts, while the dog is the emergent property. But here's a question for you. Where does the emergent property reside? Does it reside in the pile of Lego bricks? Or does it reside in your mind? Before you answer that question, let's look at another example. The Big Dipper. In one sense, the Big Dipper is just a handful of stars. But it's also more than just stars. It's that spoon-like thing. That spoon-like thing is not a feature of any individual star, but it is a feature of this particular system of stars as a whole. In other words, the Big Dipper is an emergent property. But think about this. In order to transform this handful of stars into the Big Dipper, we have to draw something like imaginary lines to connect the stars, right? Without those imaginary lines, there is no Big Dipper. But where do these lines reside? Do they exist out there in deep space? Or do they exist only in our minds? Now, at first glance, it might not be obvious that these lines exist only in our minds, even though it's patently obvious that they don't exist out in space. But if the lines do not exist out in space, we're pretty much forced to conclude that they exist in our minds, and only in our minds. And yet, it is these very lines that constitute the emergent property that we call the Big Dipper. In other words, the emergent property is entirely a construction of the mind. Now, in a simple system like the Big Dipper, this may seem obvious. But what seems obvious in this simple example is easy to lose sight of as we consider systems of greater complexity. Before continuing on, I want to introduce two important words, and I want to be very clear as to what I mean by these words. The two words are objective and subjective. Now, when I say a thing is objective, I mean the thing exists independent of our minds. In other words, if there were no minds in the universe, an objective thing would still exist. By contrast, when I say a thing is subjective, I mean the thing exists only in a mind. It is dependent upon the mind. And so if there were no minds in the universe, a subjective thing would not exist. This distinction may strike you as stark and overly simplified, but this is how I'll be using the words, and believe it or not, that's how most dictionaries define the words. Anyway, let's return to my Lego dog. In one sense, the Lego dog is just a bunch of Lego bricks, in the same way that the Big Dipper is just a bunch of stars. But like the Big Dipper, the Lego bricks get connected somehow. They get merged, and out pops this dog. The dog is an emergent property. As we consider our experience of looking at this Lego dog, we might be tempted to say that our experience consists of both objective features and subjective features. Specifically, we might say that the Lego bricks exist objectively, outside the mind, while the dog, which is an emergent property, exists subjectively inside the mind. That would probably strike most people as a reasonable judgment. But imagine for a moment that instead of a little Lego dog, I instead make a very big Lego dog. And I mean really big. This dog is the size of the Empire State Building. It's over 1,000 feet tall. And the whole thing is made up entirely of these little red and white Lego bricks. And in constructing this canine colossus, I had taken great care to alternate the red and white Lego bricks, like the squares on a checkerboard. So, I built this dog, and now you and I are going to stand back and take a look at the thing. And we're going to look at the thing from a distance of 1 mile. Now, when we look at this dog from a distance of 1 mile, something very interesting happens. From this distance, we can no longer see the individual red and white Lego bricks the dog is made of. In other words, the objective features of the scene have effectively disappeared. So what are we left with? Well, what we're left with is the emergent property. Specifically, we're left with this big dog. And not just a big dog, but a big pink dog. The red and white component parts have disappeared, and now we've got this new color, pink. Now recall that an emergent property is defined as a feature that is not found in any component of a system, but that is found in the system as a whole. In our present example, we don't observe a pink dog in any individual red or white Lego brick, but we do observe a pink dog in the system of red and white Lego bricks as a whole. By definition, the pink dog is an emergent property. But as I argued earlier, emergent properties are subjective. They exist only in the mind. Now, if you find yourself resisting that idea, I would ask you to think back to that simple example of the lines of the Big Dipper. Of course, if the pink dog is entirely an emergent property, and if emergent properties are subjective, then it follows as a matter of logical necessity that the big pink dog exists entirely in our mind. If all this strikes you as a bit weird, hang on, because things are about to get a whole lot weirder. I want to expand on this thought experiment. I want to build more stuff. Only this time, instead of a pile of Lego bricks, I now have a pile of protons, neutrons, and electrons. And I'm going to build stuff out of this pile of protons, neutrons, and electrons. And the very first thing I want to build is a Lego brick. Now, scientists tell me that Lego bricks are made of molecules, which in turn are made of atoms, which in turn are made of protons, neutrons, and electrons. Now, protons, neutrons, and electrons are extremely tiny things. So tiny, in fact, that we can't see them, not even with a very powerful microscope. But we can see a Lego brick that is made entirely out of protons, neutrons, and electrons. In other words, in looking at this Lego brick, we can see the whole, but we can't see the parts. We've encountered this situation before in the case of my big pink Lego dog. In that case, we could not see the pink dog in any single red or white Lego brick, but we could see the pink dog in the system as a whole. So the pink dog was an emergent property. But by the very same principle, this Lego brick I have just made is also an emergent property. But if the Lego brick is an emergent property, that would make it subjective. In other words, a Lego brick, something we once assumed to be objective, on closer examination turns out to be subjective. But if that's the case, then even this Lego brick exists only in my mind. What I am proposing is this. Everything we experience is an emergent property. Everything we experience is some whole composed of smaller parts. Think about this. Every object that populates your physical world is reducible to more fundamental stuff that you can't see. And even if you could see that more fundamental stuff, it wouldn't look anything like the objects that meet your senses. This table here is something that I experience as solid. But scientists tell me that at the atomic level, at least, it's mostly empty space. So what's the solid? It's an emergent property. Ponder this. I could, in principle, take the protons, neutrons, and electrons that make up this table and reassemble them into a loaf of bread, or a set of golf clubs, or a pig, or a brick of solid gold, or a human brain. What are these objects emerging from this very same pile of protons, neutrons, and electrons? They are emergent properties, and as such, they are subjective. If you happen to be sitting in a room right now, just look around at the objects in the room. The furniture, the carpet, the walls, the light fixtures, the windows. Scientists tell us that this room and everything in it is made up of protons, neutrons, and electrons. But you don't experience protons, neutrons, and electrons. You experience colors and shapes and textures. You experience emergent properties. And emergent properties are subjective. They exist only in your mind. The room you are sitting in right now is a subjective construction of your mind. And as such, the room does not exist apart from your mind. Now that's kind of weird. If you and I were to meet at your house in this room, we would operate under an assumption that we were both sitting in the very same physical room. What I'm proposing here is that this is an illusion. There is no single room that you and I are both sitting in. The room I experience is a production of my brain. The room you experience is a production of your brain. We are no more sitting in the same room than we are thinking with the same brain. What this means, then, is that there are quite literally two rooms. Now, at this point, you might be thinking, besides the fact that you think I'm out of my mind, but you might be thinking, no, there is a real room. It's just that you and I simply have two different perceptions of this real room. But there's a real room. I understand that response, including the one about me being out of my mind. But what I'm proposing here is, no, it doesn't work like that. Objectively speaking, there is no room. Think back one more time to our simple example of the Big Dipper. The Big Dipper contains seven stars. Now, we've got this whole sky full of stars, but we've decided to focus on just these seven stars. In creating the Big Dipper, we have, in effect, segregated these seven stars from all the other stars in the sky that are not the Big Dipper. This act of segregation effectively marks the boundaries of the Big Dipper, thus distinguishing the Big Dipper from everything in the sky that is not the Big Dipper. You following this? Without this act of segregation, there is no Big Dipper. Without this act of segregation, all we have is a sky full of stars, undifferentiated. But where does this act of segregation take place? Out there in space, or in your mind? Is the segregation achieved objectively or subjectively? Clearly, it's subjective. It's like those imaginary lines we talked about earlier. This act of segregation takes place in our minds. Now, let's see how this principle of segregation works with something a little bit more down to earth. Let's say a Lego brick. A Lego brick is made up of protons, neutrons, and electrons. But then, so is the table the Lego brick is sitting on. So is the air that surrounds the Lego brick. So is that bug that just crawled up on top of the thing. In other words, the Lego brick and all the stuff in the room that is not the Lego brick is made up of protons, neutrons, and electrons. This room full of protons, neutrons, and electrons is analogous to the sky full of stars in our Big Dipper example. And just as with the Big Dipper, It's only by segregating the protons, neutrons, and electrons that make up the Lego brick from all the protons, neutrons, and electrons that make up everything else that is not the Lego brick. It's only by virtue of this segregation that the Lego brick exists for us at all. But as with the Big Dipper, this segregation is achieved subjectively in our minds. Now what this means is that even the edges of things, those features that tell us where one object ends and another begins, even these are emergent properties. Even these are subjective. They exist only in our minds. And this is the case with any physical object, including this room you're sitting in right now. So objectively speaking, there is no room out there independent of your mind. Objectively speaking, the room does not exist. Now that's not to say that there isn't something out there, something independent of our minds, something truly objective. I believe there is. Let's call this the objective substratum. But this objective substratum is undifferentiated. It would be analogous to the whole sky full of stars before we started carving it up into Big Dippers and scorpions and lions and other constellations. You see, on the objective level, nothing is carved up. That's why, objectively speaking, the room does not exist. The room is a segregated and carved up thing. And all the segregating and connecting and carving up is a subjective function. And so, when you and I meet in your room, objectively speaking, there is no room. But subjectively speaking, there are two rooms. One room is a subjective production of your mind, the other room a subjective production of my mind. To be sure, these two rooms are very similar. The reason for their similarity is that both rooms are rendered from the very same objective substratum. And so, when you and I meet in the room, we can almost think of our meeting like the coming together of two musicians to perform a kind of duet. The objective substratum we share in common is like the sheet music we are both reading from. Our two brains are like two musical instruments. And our individual experiences of the room are like our individual performances of the sheet music. What I am proposing here, for your consideration, is that the physical objects we have always assumed to exist objectively are in fact subjective productions of our minds, and as such, they have no existence outside of our minds. That we call physical things objects is really a misnomer. But it's a misnomer that has been formulated within the context of a very powerful illusion. Just as the word sunrise is a misnomer that was formulated within the context of another powerful illusion. All physical objects are subjective. Just as the lines of the Big Dipper are subjective, just as the pink Lego dog is subjective, just as the single Lego brick is subjective. The physical room in which you are sitting at this very moment is subjective. It exists only in your mind. What if we venture outside the room? What are we to make of the trees and the grasses, or that pond I talked about earlier? Well, these are physical things, and according to my argument at least, they are all emergent properties, which means that they are subjective in nature and have no existence outside your mind. There's the old question, if a tree falls in a forest and no one's there to hear it, does it make a sound? Well, according to what I'm proposing here, if no one's there to hear it, not only is there no sound, there is no forest. How about something really big and really old, like the Grand Canyon? Well, the Grand Canyon is something you experience as a physical thing. According to my argument, physical things are emergent properties, and emergent properties are subjective. Hence, objectively speaking, the Grand Canyon does not exist. How about something really, really big, like the whole Earth? Well, the Earth is a physical system full of physical objects. And like all other physical things that we experience, the Earth is made up of protons, neutrons, and electrons. But we don't experience the protons, neutrons, and electrons. We instead experience a seemingly infinite variety of emergent properties. But as I have been arguing, all emergent properties are subjective. They exist only in our minds. So, objectively speaking, the earth does not exist. Okay, how about the biggest thing of all, the universe? Well, like everything else we've been talking about, the universe is something we traditionally think of as a physical system. We speak of a universe full of planets and stars and galaxies and rocks and computers and ants and people and Lego bricks. We speak of a universe full of red things and blue things and hard things and soft things. I think most people assume the universe to be a fundamentally physical system, and objectively so. In other words, all the physical objects we think of as populating the universe exist whether we are there to experience them or not. But what I am proposing here is that all the physical objects we experience are really emergent properties manufactured in our minds. And this brings me to that preposterous idea that I warned you about in the introduction. A proposal so seemingly absurd that I hesitate to even say the words out loud for fear of the laughter they're bound to excite in many of you. But here goes anyway. There is no physical universe. Let me say that again. There is no physical universe. The existence of a physical universe is an illusion. Yes, we stand outside and look around us at the grass and the trees and the houses and the cars. We look up into the evening sky at the moon and planets and the Milky Way galaxy. We look around us and we see a vast physical system. And we quite naturally assume that what we see is just the way the universe is. In other words, we assume that our universe is a physical universe. But what I'm saying is no. There is no physical universe. The physical universe is an illusion. It is the ultimate illusion. Now let me quickly clarify a few things here, just in case you think I'm proposing something that I am not. When I say there is no physical universe, I am not saying that there is no universe. I believe there is a universe. I believe it is real, and objectively so, meaning I believe the universe exists independent of our minds. But our universe is not a physical universe. It is not composed of hard things and red things and hot things and wet things. The physical properties we attribute to the universe as a whole are really just attributes of our own personal physical experience. And in believing that we live in a physical universe, we make the mistake of projecting these attributes onto the rest of the universe. Now, we've done this before. In fact, we do it all the time. We routinely project our personal mental experience onto the universe as a whole. A belief in God is evidence of this projection. What I'm arguing here is that we have done the very same thing with our personal physical experience. We have projected our own personal physical experience onto the universe as a whole. Our belief in a physical universe is evidence of this projection. It's my contention that both of these projections are mistakes. In both cases, we are guilty of creating the universe in our own image. This doesn't mean that our physical experiences are not real. I believe they are real, but they are not universally real. The physical phenomena that inhabit your experience are real to you, but they are also unique to you. In fact, they are not even shared by other human beings. We don't share the same physical experiences for the simple reason that we don't share the same brain. And it's in the brain that these experiences are manufactured. Now, while I believe our physical experiences are unique, I also believe they are very similar. It's this great similarity that enables us to communicate and coordinate our activities. Of course, this great similarity also serves to reinforce this amazing illusion. What I'm proposing here is that physical reality is not fundamental. In other words, what we experience as physically real can be reduced to a reality even more fundamental. In this sense, physical reality is analogous to a cake. A cake is not a fundamental, irreducible thing. It's made up of more fundamental things like sugar and eggs, water and flour. A cake is reducible to these more basic ingredients. What each of us experiences as physical reality is like the cake, not the ingredients. Our mistake is in thinking that the entire universe is made of cake. But that's just an illusion. The universe is ultimately made of sugar and milk and flour and eggs. And out of these basic ingredients, there emerges, here and there, little cakes, little conscious experiences. And it's within these conscious experiences, and only within these conscious experiences, that we find the physical properties that we have mistakenly projected onto the universe as a whole. And so, in the context of this cake analogy, I am a cake, and you are a cake. I suspect even my dog is a cake. But the universe is sugar and milk and flour and eggs. Now, I should probably clarify something here. Earlier, I spoke of protons, neutrons, and electrons. In referring to these subatomic particles, I don't mean to imply that these are the fundamental ingredients I just referred to in this cake analogy. In fact, scientists now believe that protons and neutrons can be reduced to something called quarks. So, in referring to protons, neutrons, and electrons, I was not identifying the fundamental ingredients of reality. Rather, I simply wanted to illustrate the emergent nature of all physical experience. So why is any of this important? Well, it's important because coming to grips with this illusion is something I believe we must do if we ever hope to unravel the mystery of human consciousness. In our attempts to solve this profound mystery, our belief in a physical universe has taunted us like a mirage in a desert. We feel certain there must be a solution, a physical solution. But as we follow the path dictated by the illusion, we find ourselves grasping at fistfuls of nothing. Our intellectual thirst remains unquenched. In seeing through this illusion, we open a corridor into a deeper reality, a reality that lies beneath the physical properties we mistakenly assume to be fundamental. And it's in that deeper reality that I believe we will find the answer we seek, the solution to the hard problem of consciousness. Now, in drawing a distinction between the physical properties that characterize individual experience and the deeper realities that characterize the universe as a whole, I have in no ways explained how the one emerges from the other. I have not explained how the subjective emerges from the objective. I will attempt to do that on the next program when I take a stab at the hard problem of consciousness. I hope you'll join me for that discussion. Until then, thank you for listening.